Talk with Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM from east of the Rockies. Dial 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, 1-800-618-8255. First-time callers may reach Ian at area code 541-665-0520. And the wildcard line is open at 541-665-0521. This is Coast to Coast AM on the Premier Radio Networks. Now, here's Ian.
Well, for those of you who are celebrating it today, happy Easter. That is to say, happy Easter to those Christians in the Western tradition, and traditionally Eastern Orthodoxy celebrating slightly later. I had a particularly wonderful day. Did some of my usual church duties, but the best and amongst the many favorite memories I'll have, I was meeting one family after a church service this morning at 9 o'clock who came up to me and said, we just put it together. We just finally figured out. They said, you're Ian Punnett. I'm in the radio. And I said, yeah. Thinking that they were meaning my other show, this one I used to do during the weeknight hours, and they said, we just love Art Bell. I was like, cool. And they're like, and their little daughter, I believe her name was Hadley, about 10 years old or so, saying, I love Ghost to Ghost. And it was an adorable moment. And so if they're listening, go back to bed. That kid's got to get up and go to church in the morning. Oh, sorry, school in the morning. I had also a wonderful time with my family. I hope you did, too. My youngest surprised me today, putting on his traditional, you know, sort of Easter outfit. We don't get him into the blazer and khaki pants very often, but, you know, he had a nice pastel-colored Easter shirt and some cool new shoes, and I caught him looking at himself in the mirror, feeling very cool, saying to himself, but audible enough, as he thought of himself somewhat Bond-like, Punnett, Campbell Punnett. And haven't we all done that at one time or another? I've gotten a lot of email in anticipation of this show this evening. I won't share a lot of it with you, although I may with the guest later on, Glenn Kimball. But so much mail, in fact, that it made me think, what was on the website? And some people said, oh, I saw what was coming up. And so I had to look at it. Of course, those of you who look ahead can always find out what's coming up at artbell.com. And soon, by the way, if you want, you'll be able to find out more about our guests. I'll probably have my website more attuned to this show in the weeks ahead. You can always look at my website if you'd like to. Punnett, P-U-N-N-E-T-T, Punnett at, Punnett.com. And as I was looking at this, it said that her, after 25 years of research, author Glenn Kimball has been able to piece together the historical framework of Jesus' childhood. Kimball will discuss the historical context of the birth of Christ, the significance of the Magi at the birth, and the global impact of Jesus. Well, that description, as provocative as that is, and has obviously gotten a lot of people curious about what's coming up during the show, doesn't quite do justice to what Glenn has in mind. Glenn has been enthusiastically researching the period of time in the life of Jesus when many people believe he was in the Orient. Glenn has letters. Glenn has unearthed some interesting narratives about the life of Jesus outside of the Middle East that I think you're going to want to hear about, especially the work of Nicholas Natovich. Some of you may already be familiar with this Russian who had gone to India, had gone along the merchant's trail, and had stumbled upon some fascinating ancient documents that purport to show that not only was Jesus a familial figure for many of the religious leaders of the East, but they considered him in his lifetime to be a spiritual brother. And what might be some of the most amazing correspondence you're ever going to hear outside of the Bible coming up next hour with our guest, Glenn Kimball. And we'll do open phones and some crypto news next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. The Tibetan people are very gentle. They're not like Smurfs. You know, I hate when people talk about people from Tibet like they're from, you know, Star Wars or something like that. You know, these are people with a tradition and have wars and have been involved in conflicts for years. But they do have this, you know, Tibetan tradition that has fascinated the East for centuries. And this comes from a foreword by Nicholas Natovich from a work which is reprinted by Glenn Kimball, and I thank you, Glenn, for sending this on. I just want to read to you a little bit before we talk to Glenn. After the close of the Turco-Russian War in 1878, I undertook a series of extended journeys throughout the Orient. Having visited all points of interest in the Balkan Peninsula, I crossed the Caucasian Mountains into Central Asia and Persia, and finally, in 1887, made an excursion into India, the most admired country of the dreams of my childhood. The first object of this journey was to study the customs and habits of the inhabitants of India amid their own surroundings, as well as the grand, mysterious archaeology and the colossal, majestic nature of the country. I also began to make my way to Ladakh, where I intended to make a somewhat lengthy stay before returning to Russia through eastern Turkestan. In the course of one of my visits to a Buddhist convent, I learned from the chief lama that there existed some very ancient memoirs treating of the life of Christ and of the nations of the Occident in the archives of the Lhasa, and that a few of the larger monasteries possessed copies and translations of these precious chronicles. An unfortunate accident whereby my leg was fractured furnished me with a totally unexpected pretext to enter the monastery, where I received excellent care and nursing, and I took advantage of my short stay amongst these monks to obtain the privilege of seeing the manuscripts relating to Christ. With the aid of my interpreter, who translated from the Tibetan tongue, I carefully transcribed the verses as they were read by the Lama. Just a fascinating beginning to what will be a fascinating show. Glenn Kimball will engage us here on the unknown life of Christ in the East, the letters, the narratives, the proof, next on Coast to Coast AM. It was probably about 5 weeks ago that I spoke last with Glenn Kimball on the phone about this show, just before Glenn sent me a passel of books and related material to tonight's topic. But Glenn, I swear, it has passed like 5 months. That's how much I've been looking forward to the show. It just seemed to take forever to get from our last time together to now, and it's great to finally get it underway. So thank you for making this a memorable Easter broadcast for many people who are celebrating it today.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you. What a great way to spend an evening, especially an Easter evening.
Well, it's so interesting because even people outside of the Christian tradition, or perhaps people who aren't at all religious, will also find this adventure as interesting as I do, because the story you have to tell, Glenn, and the research you've been doing on this, I would think would be a great story regardless of anybody's background. And I don't want you to approach this topic like I know anything about it, because there's so much detail that I'm afraid we're going to lose along the way. So take us back, if you would, to the origins of this pursuit. I just read the work of Nicholas Natovich. Is he the first person that begins to pursue this idea of Jesus in the Orient?
Not at all. In the packet of information that I sent to you, you obviously had another document which has survived this millennia since the post-crucifixion era, and the Apocrypha has been published. And that is the largest apocryphal book in the survives period. That book is called The Apocryphal Acts of Thomas. In The Apocryphal Acts of Thomas are the stories, the miracles, the healings, the delightful events that took place under the directorship of Thomas, Jesus' little brother, as he performed his post-crucifixion missionary work. Where, of all places, but in India. And that document actually predates a letter. Well, the letter came first, but the documentation comes to us from the Nicene Council, the great father Eusebius. In Eusebius's book, and I think I sent you a copy of that as well, Eusebius records for us one of the many writings of Christ that survive in our day. That most people who think of Jesus think, well, he didn't write anything. No, wrong. That's not true. He wrote many things, and we're going to talk about several things that he wrote in his own hand tonight. But one of those things that was recorded by one of the extremely well-respected men, Eusebius, who was called the father of ecclesiastical history and was the Archbishop of Caesarea under Constantine. In this letter, one of the royal family members of India literally is pleading for Christ to come to India, and Jesus, in essence, to return to India, because Christ had already been in India once before. They certainly well knew Jesus well in India. That's the reason why they're writing to have him come to India in the first place, is because they knew him and respected him greatly not only because one of the Magi was from India who came to the birth of Christ, but because of their own messianic traditions, which were before Sanskrit ever was written. But let's not get fragmented here, but to suggest, no, there are other... There were older documents that were recorded about the relationship of Christ in the East. There's a notion of them that are coming at us in our day and age, which I find to be not only fascinating, but an absolutely integral part of breaking down the Oriental Wall, which has divided the Eastern religions from the Western religions since the death of Christ.
All right. Well, let's jump in here then and say, what's the first mechanism? When does this begin? Obviously, there's no biblical record of this. So right away, people aren't brought up in the Christian tradition knowing anything about this. So what's our earliest evidence, or what is it that's there that suggests to us that there was a reason, there was a motive, there was an opportunity for Jesus to travel to the Orient?
The story really begins at the death of Joseph, who was married to the Virgin Mary. Jesus, this is another one of those documents that Jesus wrote and survives into our century. It's called the Serapion document. And by the way, that's included in its entirety in my first book, Hidden Stories of the Childhood of Jesus, the very last story. Jesus' father died when Jesus was about 14 or 15 years old and does not appear anywhere by the time of the crucifixion scene. The next of kin who was responsible to take the body of Christ down from the cross was, in fact, the great Joseph of Arimathea, who was Mary's uncle and Jesus' great-uncle. So at the death of Joseph, who was Jesus' earthly father, the protectorship of the family rightfully, dutifully, and under the law of the Jews, went to the next of kin. And the person who stepped up to that bar was, in fact, Joseph of Arimathea, who was the wealthy merchant mentioned in the scriptures, was the noblest decurio mentioned in the Augustine letters, as well as in Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire and half a dozen other books. Joseph of Arimathea was a wealthy merchant. and as such, as the protector of Christ through his teenage years and his young manhood, Christ had the opportunity to follow the merchant traffic of his great uncle wherever that might have gone. Certainly that traffic originated in England, where Joseph of Arimathea owned the Mendip mines in England, and from which those Mendip mines he sold tin and lead around the world. In fact, the Roman Tiberius Caesar had named Joseph of Arimathea the grand noblis decurio, which meant noble provider. He was the Dale Carnegie of sorts of his day. And so Jesus was able to follow those trade routes. Now, we have to understand by the time of the birth of Christ that the trade routes to the east were well trafficked. We have solid evidence today that for the 100 years prior to the birth of Christ, that there was a caravan all the way from Jerusalem into the east and back and forth along the Silk trade routes, along the Himalayas, all the way through Tibet, every single month for over 100 years. And that merchant traffic had existed as early as 1800 years B.C., and there's evidence that even goes farther back than that. We find goods, products, and other kinds of evidence, writings, financial letters, etc., that exist in China that come from Jerusalem, glass beads, other kinds of artifacts that were specifically manufactured in Jerusalem, and vice versa. We find goods and products that were manufactured in the Orient, in Jerusalem, and beyond. When the Roman Empire decided to conquer the eastern province of Judea, they did so because it was a rich province centered in the trade routes from east to west. We often think of Jerusalem as and Palestine at the time of Christ as being a poor country. That is totally ridiculous. For example, are you there?
Yeah, I'm right here.
There was a great click on the line.
I'm sorry to hear that. Don't go anywhere.
Yeah, anyway, that distracted me a moment.
I'm sorry, you were talking about prosperous Middle East.
Oh, yeah, the prosperous Middle East. We have evidence of that. For example, the Pharisees, which occupied 10 or 11% of the population of Palestine at the time of Christ, were wealthy merchants, were entrepreneurs. Wouldn't it have been nice in our country today if 10 or 11% of our people were entrepreneurs? Our percentages of entrepreneurship fall well below 10 or 11%, which was the case at the time of Christ, which indicates that in Judea, at the time of Jesus, it was the 100 years of the most successful merchant traffic in the history of the world up until that time. And Jesus, having been kin to probably the most wealthy merchant in Judea at that time, and certainly well known to the entire Roman Empire, and pointed to a post that was unique in the Roman Empire. Cicero said that it was harder to be a Roman senator than noblis decurio. So we know that Joseph of Arimathea was an extremely prominent man, that Jesus had ample opportunity to go to travel in the trade routes. Now we know from the letters that exist and from the correspondence and from the evidence that has been coming in, up from the east, namely two documents we're going to talk about today, and then an ocean of additional material that's coming in sequence here and will be released here in the future, that Christ spent part of that time. He followed his great uncle into India through the trade routes, which took him through Persia all the way down through Tibet and Nepal into India, and back again along those trade routes. So, while he was in that traffic, while he was a young man, Christ had the opportunity, to pause with the Grand Lamas in Nepal and then again up in Tibet and to interface with these people. They respected him and liked him so much. He was a great teacher. Obviously, Christ was not short of words. He was a great orator, and people would follow him wherever he went, especially a simple, loving people like the Tibetan people.
Well, actually, and this at least is offered as tacit proof for this, that I have a friend who just got back from India, and Blaine was telling me that there are several, but one or two well-known temples, Jewish temples built along what would have been the old trade route. and one of which is still prosperous and well-visited even today, that there are literally just obviously generations of people who came along those trade routes, stayed. They are Indian, but they're Jewish Indians, and they have been there, you know, for centuries.
And, you know, that's very interesting you'd say that, because it goes the other way, too. We have just uncovered the evidence. Blavatsky just wrote his new book about the evidence that there was a Buddhist monastery on the shores of where? The Dead Sea itself at the time of Christ.
Hmm.
And so the East and West were far closer to in Jesus' day than they are in our day. The East and West were politically, spiritually, certainly culturally different, but spiritually they were connected. And one of the things they held in common was Christ himself. And the Messianic traditions, one of them, as I had mentioned before, one of the Magi was certainly from India. One was from Persia, one was from Arabia. All of these were Eastern Magi that had records of the Messiah, had evidence of what would happen at his birth and what he would do in his life and what would happen at his death. And they came and visited him, and they brought a king's ransom. There's a record just came out about the amount of wealth that was carried on the camels by the Magi to the birth of Christ, enough wealth that would have kept 100 families wealthy for 100 years.
We'll get to a lot of this. Glenn Kimball's research on this subject is well known to regular Coast to Coast listeners. The unknown life of Jesus in the Orient is a particular focus here. Glenn was talking about the trade routes, obviously making a huge impact culturally, a cross-cultural impact. One of those people that traveled the trade routes is the guy I read from earlier, Nicholas Natovich. I want to get more into his story, which has a distinct sort of Shangri-La-like tinge to it. And I'm anxious to get into the actual writings themselves of this little documented aspect of religious tradition on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Ponet. Questions and comments for Glenn Kimball coming up, probably starting somewhere next hour, although I'm not going to commit yet to when. I have a feeling that Glenn will be with us for many hours yet to come, because we're just beginning to get to the real story of those missing years, that period in the life of Jesus between about Bar Mitzvah and about the age of 30. Somewhere in there is a missing record of the traditional Christian community that Glenn and others have been looking into for much of their lives. And Glenn, the first guy that I'd ever read about who had come across this was Nicholas Natovich. I'd seen his work referred to, quoted in others. Tell us the story of Nicholas Natovich and how his experience paralleled those of many travelers going from the Middle East to the East along those trade routes.
Nicholas Natovich was very fortunate. He was a Russian correspondent in 1887. Who was touring on behalf of the Russian government, or the Russians as they existed in 1887, was a correspondent or, in essence, a journalist, and was touring India and Tibet, and was coming up through Persia and basically doing a tour, writing pieces back for newspaper articles. And he came across, he had an unfortunate experience where one of his fellow travelers was accosted and actually eaten by a panther or something as they were traveling along, and he actually broke his leg as well, as you mentioned in the earlier moments, and he had a chance to be nursed to health by the Buddhists, the good Buddhists, who were very, very gregarious people, and spent a great deal of time there. One thing I wanted, in terms of perspective, I think we ought to talk about, bring one fact out, and that is that in the West, we are kind of like one book religions. We have Bible, we have the Torah, we have the Quran. In the East, that's very different. By the time of Christ, there were about 87,000 books in their holy volumes. That's a figure that has been recently bantered about by scholars, about 87,000 volumes. So in other words, a scholar in the West could read the Bible or the Torah or the Quran, in a week or two, and have read the entirety of their holy scriptures. In the East, that could not possibly be the case, especially at the time of Christ. It has been suggested that a holy man in the East could read his entire life from the holy books and not get a tenth of the way through. And so when you're traveling in the East and you're talking to holy men in the East, one group will know one group of documents, and you'd have to travel on and talk to another group in order for them to know a different set of documents. It's an attest to the fact that it really comes from the Maccabean movement back three centuries before Christ, when we began our book burnings and we eliminated, in essence, in Jerusalem, all but the five books of Moses were, in essence, ostracized, and the word heresy began, and we began throwing books out, burning books, eliminating books, editing all kinds of things to keep to limit it down to a single volume of religious holy text. But in the East, that's just not the case. As a matter of fact, in the East, they have another principle which is very important, which contributes to this Natovich scenario, and that is that they believe that a holy man could have been anybody. The mantle of Buddha could have fallen on anyone. Whoever the mantle of Buddha fell on, they accepted him. It could be a pauper, it could be a king, it could be a foreigner, it didn't matter. And when you die, that mantle of Buddha returns back to the collective consciousness. This is a part of Buddhist dogma, in essence. And so what happened is that he was very fortunate, Nicholas Natovich was very fortunate to have been in a location where one of the Grand Lamas had suggested that he knew about Jesus, and that Natovich had been a Byzantine Christian and knew about Christianity from his Byzantine background, his Eastern Orthodox religious background. And he asked specifically about Christ, and because his family had been religious when he was young. And so what happened was is that the Lama had coincidentally read that portion of the ancient holy books, which contained the actual teachings of a man called the Buddha Issa, ISSA, a holy man who had come in the meridian of time in the first century A.D., had taught the Buddhist monks, had read the Buddhist scriptures, spent a great deal of time there, and become a well-respected individual. And then at the very end of his stay, he was a very young man, according to the records. At the very end of his stay, he told the lamas at that time that he had to return to Jerusalem and continue his mission, and that he would be ultimately martyred for a cause. And this person, who was the Buddha Issa, really was, in fact, Jesus as he traveled through India.
And here in the writings, then, we introduce this term, Issa, I-S-S-A, where that becomes sort of, in the Buddhist tradition, synonymous with Jesus?
Well, My little brother spent some significant time in Bahrain for the federal government. I won't talk about why. There's all the secret things in the army, but Isa is an Eastern name. There is a one of the heads of the Bahrain government is called Isa as well. So Isa may very well have been a title of sorts, and I suspect that it continues to be that in our day. The Buddha Isa, however, referring back to the events surrounding the visit of Jesus to Tibet in particular.
So here's Nicholas Natovich. Here's this Russian journalist. Here's a guy who is fulfilling his dream of going to India and heading toward Tibet and wanting to see the tallest mountains and meet the most intriguing people. And he comes across this document, and he has it translated for him. Tell us about what that document was and what it meant to him right away.
Well, it was actually read to him aloud, and he had a scribe. Because he was a journalist, these men were trained in writing materials, you know, and recording what was said and done. And he actually, while he was recuperating, had the Grand Lama read from the text and recorded these writings. In essence, it was the writings of a Buddhist as he interacted in Tibet, and it had a it was an interesting flavor because it talked very significantly about Christian-like things. And one of the things that's been asked of me in the last couple of days is, you know, we had this ongoing street banter that suggests that Christ taught a reincarnation, and that those documents were left out of the Bible somehow, and that they were deleted from the Bible. If that were true, which it is not, certainly Christ would have mentioned that doctrine in a document like that of Natovich's, where it contains many of the simple, the very commonly known teachings of Christ that we know. It would have taught along with that. It would have been fair game, because the Buddhists obviously believe in reincarnation, and the Hindus do as well, believe in a reincarnation of sorts. So one of the things that I thought was most interesting as I read it is the absolute absence of any reference to reincarnation in the Natovich document, totally.
So he takes this document and does what with it?
Well, he takes it, he brings it back to Russia, and he publishes it in his books and writings, and he's not well received. I mean, there are people that are very curious. There's kind of like a cult-like procession that followed him, but it's largely not well received in our day. And it was published, and it has been published a couple of times over the last 100 years, but it has not really gotten very famous. Well, you'd think that this very book, containing some of the original teachings of Christ in Tibet, might be a sensational bestseller. But it really struggled in the marketplace. In our day, it never caught on in Russia. It has been, even though that it's been an interesting book for those who have taken the time to read it, it's been in essence, a bust in terms of publication itself. It actually probably contributed to the ultimate, I believe Nicholas Natovich felt himself to be a failure in the end, felt like he hadn't really contributed to society, and that he felt like the very real message that he had taken out of India really was not well received, and that he felt like a failure.
Well, I want to know more about that, and I know that everybody listening does too. So I'll just ask you, Glenn, to leaf through here. Let's actually read a little bit of what you think it was that was so startling about this message that made it so controversial as to keep it from being embraced. And when we come back, Glenn Kimball will read to us from this document, this ancient manuscript,
dictated to Russian journalist Nicholas Natovich back in the 19th century as he attempted to spread the word of the discovery of this amazing artifact showing that Jesus had spent time along the trade routes in India and Tibet. Next, and just what does it say? On Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett.
Want the best radio in the world? Tired of a radio that keeps fading out? Well, not all fades can be stopped. I mean, the atmosphere is the atmosphere. However, the CC radio will, compared to the radio you have now, unless you have one of these, stop about 90% of the fading that you experience. It's that much better. It's so good that it's the last radio you'll ever need to buy, unless they make an improved model of this someday. Otherwise, this is it. I mean, you cannot spend your money on a better radio. AM, there is no radio on the planet that will compare to it. FM is excellent. It comes with television audio, so you can actually, in bed, you can listen to a Nightline. You don't miss much in the visual. And you get all the meaning. So TV audio is kind of nice to have for a lot of things. And then it also has NOAA weather and NOAA weather alert. God knows it's getting violent out there. Be careful in the Midwest. It's coming your way later today. No question about it. Be heads up, boy. If you had this radio on and you had the alarm, the weather alarm activated, and something bad were coming your way, it would alarm, and then it would turn on NOAA, which would explain to you to be taking shelter or what, you know, whatever is headed your way. It might save your life. But most of all, it's the best radio you're ever going to own. It is expensive. $159.95. It's worth every penny. I never have anybody complain. I never have anybody say, gee, I wish I hadn't spent that much. When you get it, you know it's that good. Call Bob Crane in the morning at 6:30 a.m. Pacific Time, 9:30 back east. Adjust individually in between. And call 1-800-522-8863. You can get one. 1-800-522-8863. You can see it on the web, by the way, at ccradio.com.
For over 60 years, Schiff has made the difference.
Schiff makes the difference between an ordinary vitamin E and a premium vitamin E.
The difference.
By using natural vitamin E because it's twice as effective as synthetic E. By combining four types of vitamin E, not just the single type found in other leading brands.
Schiff makes the difference.
Providing premium vitamin E supplements worth more because they offer more. Schiff
makes the difference.
Making a difference in vitamins, making a difference in you. Schiff.
Telephone tip.
From Geico Auto Insurance.
When calling Geico to switch your car insurance, you will not need acetaminophen, naproxen, indomethacin, ibuprofen, a cold compress, an on-call acupuncturist, or any other pain remedy. In 15 minutes, you could save 15% or more. If it were any more painless, you could do it in your sleep, which is theoretically possible since we offer complete 24-hour service. Call 1-800-947-AUTO. 1-800-947-AUTO. Geico Direct. The sensible alternative.
So Glenn Kimball has been following the trade routes in his mind, tracking the unknown life of Jesus through India and into Tibet. And Glenn, I'm sure you would love nothing more than to actually walk those same roads yourself someday. But until you or I have the chance to actually do that and make it up to the top of one of those monasteries and look for whatever document they might have in their archives, read us a little bit of what we do have that Nicholas Natovich brought back in the 19th century. Glenn?
Do you have your copy with you, Ian?
I do.
Turn to page 41, and there's an important, I think there's an absolutely critical part there in, there's chapter 12, verse 7. Jesus says something about women which is very, very atypical for both Jewish, Roman, or Greek men. It has to do with women, and it's a parable. Well, it was an actual event that happened at that moment where he says, at this point, an aged woman who had approached the group that she might better hear Isa was pushed aside by one of the men in disguise who placed himself before her. Isa then said, "It is not meet that a son should push aside his mother to occupy the first place which should be hers. Whosoever respecteth not his mother, the most sacred thing next to God, is unworthy of the name of son. Listen, therefore, to what I am about to say. Respect women, for she is the mother of the universe, and all the truth of divine creation dwells within her. She is the basis of all that is good and beautiful, as she is also the germ of life and death. On her depends the entire existence of man, for she is his moral and natural support in all his works. She gives you birth amid sufferings by the sweat of her brow. She watches over your growth until her death. You cause her the most intense anguish. Bless her and adore her, for she is your only friend and support upon the earth." And I got to go on because this comes to a very important point in just a moment. "Respect her, protect her, and in doing this you will win her love and her heart, and you will be pleasing to God. For this shall many of your sins be remitted." Did you get that?
Yeah.
"Therefore, love your wives and respect them, for tomorrow they shall be mothers and later grandmothers of a whole nation. Be submissive toward your wife. Love as her love ennobles man, softens his heart, tames the beast, and makes it a lamb." And it goes on to the very end talking about women. This was very, very atypical of a Jew, of a Roman, of a Greek, and to be very candid with you, was atypical of a Byzantine Christian as well.
You know, it's interesting, though, is to say that there are echoes of this, there are obviously reflections of this that exist in the text. Jesus is very pro-woman in the existing texts, the mainstream texts, and that in itself already marks him as different, but this is so much more so of that, philosophical road of seeing women as not just equals, but worthy of so much respect that, as you point out, that God will forgive your sins, depending on how well you treat women, that you can be forgiven for other things if you're good to your mother and good to your wife and good to the women in your life. That is very interesting. So you believe it's texts like it's parts like that that kept this from becoming a runaway bestseller, because it was very challenging to the people that were reading, and they're going, "Well, this must not be Jesus, because, or, you know, why would he say this if it means upsetting the order of the world like this?"
Exactly, Ian. That's exactly correct. And yet, this text is full of the passion of Christ, and we haven't even got to the second text that we're going to talk about in a moment, but this text is filled. People will ask me all the time, "Why do we need more of the words of Christ?" Well, haven't you and I just tonight given ample evidence why?
Well, so the Buddhists record this, and they maintain it. Why? Why do they record it, and why do they treasure it?
Because the Buddha, remember that the mantle of Buddha could have fallen on anyone. And the Buddhist realized after Jesus had spent some time there that the mantle of Buddha had fallen on Jesus. And many people, and this is going to sound shocking to both East and West, many people consider the passion and the doctrine and the sayings and teachings of the Buddha Isa, namely Christ, are more important than the teachings of the Grand Dalai Lama himself. Now, I don't want to demean the Grand Dalai Lama. I've met the man, and I'll be honest with you, I met him sitting on a kitchen floor, and he was talking to the cook, and tears rolled down my face as there were other famous people in that room, and he could have been speaking with them. He would rather talk to the cook, and I loved that about him. But there were people at the time that thought Buddhism was more important.
Well, let's talk about that other document then when we come back. The apocryphal gospels, the lesser known but slightly more mainstream recordings of sayings and events. The unknown life of Jesus. It is the life work of Glenn Kimball. You can look up to him through artbell.com and get more by hanging on next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. It's an occasion, and we don't do this type of show very often, but it is an occasion for some people to sort of come to grips with the idea that maybe there is an answer to the age-old Christian tradition of where was Jesus between 13 and 30. Maybe it isn't an unanswerable question after all. Maybe there is not just testimony, but documentation that the life of Jesus had taken him into some fairly far-flung places where he had enjoyed some respect before returning home. And that brings us back to Tibet. Glenn Kimball has been researching this subject for a lot of years now. So, Glenn, tell us, why do you think this kind of caught on in Tibet? We were just sort of talking about that before the break. What about the Tibetan people, do you think, took to this message or took to this messenger that there was a real affection going on cross-culturally during the life of Jesus?
Well, we know, as I said earlier in the show, that one of the Magi came from India. And one from Persia, which are really not Tibet, but they are very close to Tibet. And then another one came from Arabia. The Messianic traditions were far more prevalent before the birth of Christ than we can imagine. There are a lot of people who suggest because we don't extend ourselves beyond the Bible to look for it, that the Messianic prophecies are missing somehow. Well, probably a lot of them are, but not all of them. The Messianic traditions, the Messianic suggestions were not originated in Jerusalem and did not stay in Jerusalem. We know that the very first people to build a temple on the Dome of the Rock, and this is before the pyramids were built by 200 years, before the Khufu pyramid anyway, on the Giza Plateau, that the Greek Druids had built a temple on the side of the Dome of the Rock in expectation of their Messiah, and whose name would be, in their prophecy, H-E-S-U-S, Jesus. They had the name right. And so both East and West had heard about this Messianic figure. There's some confusion among scholars today suggesting that because there was Apollonius and other kinds of mimics that were mimics to the Messiah legends, that there was some confusion over who really was the Messiah and that Jesus was just one of the crowd that emerged successful in the legends and in the newspaper. That's totally ridiculous. Not that these other pretenders did not exist at the time of Christ, because they most certainly did. But the Messianic prophecies were clear. They were clear in the sense that the Messiah would be born of virgin birth, that he would heal the sick, raise the dead, be born in the meridian of time, save the people from their sins, be nailed to a cross, die for the sins of the world, and then be resurrected. There are people who suggest that this is that the Jesus legends were really the anthropomorphization of the Isis and Osiris pagan mythology. That's not true, because Isis and Osiris, the pagan Isis-Osiris mythology, came after the messianic traditions had been written and been bandied about for millennia. The oldest, probably this oldest cocoon of spiritual understanding we have in the world surrounds the concept of the Messiah, who would be nailed to a cross, die for the sins of the world, and be resurrected. And because that has been borrowed or paid for or lent to or whatever many other religious beliefs throughout the centuries, Jesus really is a phenomenal match to the messianic prophecies.
Okay. So what other material then supports this idea that there was a life of Jesus outside of the Middle East?
Well, you and I need to do the show on how it in the West, but let's do the one on the East tonight. Remember Nicholas Natovich published his first, or traveled in India in 1887. 5 years later now, Reverend Owsley from the West. Now, remember Nicholas Natovich is Russian. He's in the East. He doesn't know Reverend Owsley at all. Reverend Owsley goes to Tibet. He befriends an entirely different set of lamas, and he has them read from another one of these 87,000 volumes that they have, and what does he find? Probably one of the finds of all time. He finds a copy of the New Testament. A New Testament. Now remember, there are many versions of the New Testament at the time of Christ. We settled on the version of the New Testament at the Nicene Council in 325 A.D., but they found a copy of this New Testament in Tibet. He jumps up and down and says, oh my goodness, there is a copy of the New Testament here, which contains many of the stories nearly identical to that of the New Testament, but it contains stories which are, in fact, not in the New Testament. In other words, we're talking about an expanded version of the New Testament. This is a find now, let's be specific, within five years of Natovich's find in Tibet. Now, this is a long time before the communists came through and destroyed 4,500 Buddhist monasteries in China and in Tibet. That's the condition of Buddhism in our day. But it was not the condition of Buddhism and the Buddhist monasteries in the day of Nicholas Natovich and Reverend Owsley. These monasteries had thousands of Buddhist monks who were trained to read and to recopy these ancient texts over and over again, because ancient texts grow old and they start to disintegrate. And part of the responsibility of these celibate, monk-like people was to be scribes and to copy documents over and over to keep them fresh. As a matter of fact, that was a big tradition at the time of Christ. Mark the Apostle and Paul the Apostle were both trained in the scribal schools in Alexandria, Egypt, to do that very same thing. They learned that ancient manuscripts deteriorate. They fall apart. And so what you do as a scribe, that was almost a religious position, if not a religious position.
Sure. Yeah, it was.
By the time of Christ, was to copy text over and over again to keep them from being lost.
Well, and to share them.
And to share them.
And, as the monasteries tended to do, you know, you built up one monastery like you would build up, like a successful television show before a spinoff, or a successful hamburger joint before a franchise or something, and you get momentum going, and then you copy all of your documents, and then you go start another one. You take 25% of your best monks, and you head off to start another one, and keep building it that way. Let's take a look then at this other document, the one that was found separate from the Natovich find, and we'll read from that and tell you more about it. Plus,
read you the letters, the writings of Jesus, as Glenn pointed out last hour, in Western and Eastern Christian tradition, the only time that Jesus is mentioned to have written anything was when he was sort of doodling in the sand. All we know is that he was sort of writing in the dirt. That's the only known reference to anything that Jesus wrote until now. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett.
Would you like to feel 10 years younger in 10 weeks? Now there's proof. The effects of aging can be slowed down and even reversed with HGH, human growth hormone. For some time now, you've heard me talk about the incredible age-reversing benefits of HGH. Well, according to thousands of articles, higher HGH levels can help you look and feel younger. That's why I take Ultimate HGH, a natural formula to help boost my body's own production of HGH. If your goal is to help improve energy, stamina, lose unwanted fat, diminish wrinkles, enhance memory, immune function, and vision, then Ultimate HGH is for you too. Why let Mother Nature get the best of you? Call today and order Ultimate HGH. And when you order two bottles of Ultimate HGH, you get the third absolutely free, about $33 a month. Now that's a tremendous savings off the typical $100 a month for comparable products. Plus, with your order, you'll receive a free book on HGH, a $20 value, absolutely free. So, call my good friends at Great American Products and order Ultimate HGH today at 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. 1-800-557-4627. Imagine for just a moment that you could turn your home into a germ-free zone. I'm talking about not getting sick anymore. No more colds, no more flu, no more allergies, no more asthma attacks. Wow. Sounds incredible. I thought so too. But thanks to a patented breakthrough technology designed for germ warfare by the U.S. military, now you can literally destroy germs. Turn your home into a germ-free zone today. Folks, this is revolutionary. It's called the Healthy Air 5000, and it's clinically proven to kill 100% of the viruses and germs in your home. Forget HEPA filtration. This blows it away. No more germs, no more dust, no more pollen, mold, mites, and dander. The Healthy Air eliminates them all. You may never get sick again. Try the Healthy Air 5000 risk-free for 30 days. Dial 800-313-PURE. Folks, call now and save $100. Do it now. Call 800-313-PURE. 100% guaranteed. They're standing by now. 800-313-PURE.
The unknown life of Jesus along the merchant's trail to the Orient. The documents exist and they have been rediscovered through the work of Glenn Kimball and others. We're sharing them with you here on this occasion because there is more to this literature than most people in their lifetime, in their religious lifetime, know about. The canon, or you know, the New Testament canon, has preserved some of the most interesting documents to Western and Eastern Christians. However, even there, in reading the New Testament, there's lots of references to writings that we don't have now. You know, we have in the writings of Paul, for example, and the Apostle Paul, he talks about other letters that other people have written. Wouldn't it be cool to have those? Wouldn't it be neat to see all of the material that was floating around in that period? Well, some of it does exist. And Glenn Kimball was just telling us about some of them. So, Glenn, help me out with this. What's the most... I know you'll probably be tempted to read a lot of what you have there from Thomas, but tell us a little bit more about this particular document and what you think is in it that is its most controversial.
Well, we have to remember that this particular... I call it the Tibetan New Testament.
Okay.
that keeps it separate from Natovich's, the Buddhista document. So let's keep them separate by calling them those two names. The Tibetan New Testament, how did it get into Tibetan hands? Well, we have to remember that Christ had visited in Tibet. He had lived there. He had taught there. And that his brother James knew very well that Christ had traveled those routes and had the same relationship, or a very similar relationship to Joseph of Arimathea. And James himself emerges as an Essene in the post-crucifixion era. The Essenes now, let's describe them for just a moment for our audience. The Essenes were very, very conservative Jewish religious group. They lived together, huddled together, almost like you would think in a monastery amongst perhaps Catholics or other kinds of people today who live in a celibate, monk-like behavior. They would meditate all day. They would grow plants. They would be vegetarians, etc. They would be celibate. They would not marry. They would live sequestered from other people in monasteries. This is what the Essene, the clergy of the Essenes lived like. And certainly James was considered part of that group. There are many people who think that James, the brother of Christ, was in fact the teacher of righteousness spoken of in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, as you're well aware, your audience should know. If not, we'll tell them. The Dead Sea Scrolls were preserved by these monk-like Essenes. The Essenes did their job, which was to collect the texts, bury them, and protect them. Well, James was an Essene. James knew that Jesus had been in Tibet. And we get this Tibetan New Testament via the Essenes who had sent it to Tibet, probably through James, to keep it safe in the post-crucifixion era. Now, after the death of Christ, things heated up. By 66 A.D., it was open warfare between Jews and Romans. By 70 A.D., the entire temple had been brought to ruins. And we could talk for an entire day on what happened the day that they ruined the temple there, and what that has to do with René Lachateau. By the way, the guest from right. The former hour, we could talk about the treasure that was taken out of there to the Pyrenees by the Romans and what they left. We won't talk about that. We're going to get really fragmented if we do. But in essence, this copy of James was very concerned that all records of Christ would be eliminated. And James had been specifically asked by Jesus, and so had Thomas and so had Matthew, been specifically asked by Jesus to write records and to have them preserved. So one of the responsibilities that James had, remember he's an Essene, was to protect documents. Well, knowing that Christ had been in India, knowing the sanctuaries of the Buddhist monasteries had not been violated, James sent a copy of the New Testament as it existed, probably three or four decades after the death of Christ, sent a copy that was being written at that time to be preserved in Tibet. Now, remember, the Tibetans believed in the Buddhism. They shared Christ in common with the West. And so it shouldn't be really difficult for us to understand why they might accept a copy of the New Testament, why they might value it, and why they might protect it. Certainly that would be a logical assumption on the part of the Tibetans, even though they might not view Jesus as as the Son of God. They certainly viewed him as the Buddha Isa,
okay,
who was a prophet amongst themselves.
So give us an example of this Tibetan New Testament.
Well, we could read all night. And perhaps that's probably what we should do, shut up and let Jesus speak for himself. But I didn't come prepared to do that, but I'll read you a little part of this.
Great.
Jesus appeared in the temple and blood sacrifices ceased. Now, this is after the death of Jesus. This is further evidence that Jesus was, in fact, resurrected, okay?
Yeah.
Because this survives in our day. The same day, at the time of the sacrifice in the temple, there appeared among the dealers in beasts and birds one clothed in white raiment, bright as light, and in his hand a whip of seven cords. He had already thrown the money changers out just a few days before, remember that? And at the sight of them, those who sold and bought fled in terror, and some of them fell as dead, for they remembered how before his death Jesus had driven them from the temple enclosure in like manner. And some declared that they had seen a spirit, and others said that they had seen him who was crucified, that he had risen from the dead. And the sacrifices ceased that day in the temple, for all were in fear, and none could be had to sell or buy, but rather they let their captives go free. And the priests and the elders caused a report to be spread that they who had seen it were drunken and had seen nothing, but many affirmed that they had seen with their own eyes and felt on their backs the scourge that they were powerless to resist. For when some of the bolder among them put forth their hands, they could not seize the form which they had beheld, nor grasp the whip which had chastened them. Now here's a story of Jesus returning to the site of the money changers in the temple with a whip in his hands and throwing them out a second time. Now here's another historical vignette for you. Edersheim, who wrote the one of the greatest historical books in history about the life of Christ, tells us that those bazaars that were selling doves and beasts to be sacrificed in the temple were all owned by a consortium owned by one man. That man was Annas. And Annas was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was the chief high priest in the Sanhedrin. And Annas was the first man to whom Jesus was taken after he was arrested in Gethsemane. He was the man who owned those little shops, those merchant shops. Every single one of those people who came and sold beasts had to pay him a fee. In other words, one of the motivations, albeit in my opinion one of the minor motivations, but one of the motivations for Annas having Jesus arrested, for it was surely Annas who had Jesus arrested, not Pontius Pilate, as evidenced by the fact that Jesus was taken first to Annas, he was in control of the police force that had Jesus arrested, was the fact that Annas had been offended when Christ threw his money changers out.
All right. It is it's a moment of truth, though. So we've heard from the Tibetan New Testament. We've read from the Tibetan documents recovered by Nicholas Notovitch, the 19th century Russian journalist. Sort of weighting material and ordering what was important and what was valid. And what does he say about it?
I love Eusebius for one reason. He was the great ally of Arius. We must get back to tell our audience what we're talking about here. The Nicene Council was convened for many reasons, not the least of which was because there were more fragmented religions after the death of Christ than there are today. That Nicene Council, under the directorship of Constantine, who had had an epiphanal experience on the battlefields of Spain. He was trying to put the church back together. It was an enormous political problem for this guy. He was a believer in Christ, though he had ancestors. He had Caesars before him who had believed in Jesus. He was trying to marry Christianity with Rome. And to do so was an enormous political problem for Constantine. Even though he was Caesar and could dictate many things with his own will, by the word of his own mouth, he still had a political problem. The third or fourth generation apostolic fathers who were Christians after Christ were fighting with each other over who had the best library. And I'm being really, really oversimplified here, which is a little bit of a distortion of the truth, but I'm doing it so that the audience can have a concept of what really happened. They were fighting, saying, I got a better library, I knew Christ better, my city was the place where Peter came, my city was the place where Philip came, my city was the place where Paul came, my city was the place where Thomas dropped off and did his laundry. I mean, it was all kinds of silly reasons why these people were fighting with each other, and they were fighting sometimes over who had the most letters from Paul, who had the most visits of Peter, and they were all trying to surface as the grand leader of this Christian movement. Well, Constantine could not eliminate these bickering fourth, fifth generation apostolic fathers without killing Christianity entirely. He couldn't do it. So he had to leave them in place, even though they were quarrelsome, bickering little kids. But he had one enormous enemy in the South. And that came in the form of Arius. Arius was a bishop in Alexandria, Egypt. And Arius, unlike the apostolic fathers in the north, had collected enormous libraries and collections of the words of Christ, had collected enormous numbers of books in the grand tradition of the Alexandria Library, which was a very Greek tradition under Alexandria the Great. The bishops in the north were all for destroying everybody else's library but their own. And that came to them legitimately, this behavior came to them legitimately, because their fathers had been big book burners too, all the way back to the Maccabean movement to 3rd century B.C. So what happened is you had a bunch of arrogant fathers, priests, apostolic fathers, who were fighting over what records should be included and which ones were not. Now, Constantine, if he would have done this thing correctly, he would have sent out an epistle to the entire world and said, bring to me all the manuscripts about Christ so that we might preserve them. That's what he should have done. Politically, he could not do that and did not do that. As a matter of fact, of all those who made submissions for inclusion in the canon, he took but a small fragment of those. And Arius in the South, who had the most of everybody, was the object of condemnation, and in essence he was told to shut up or we're going to call you a heretic, which was tantamount to him having a death sentence. Are you there?
Yeah, sure I am. I mean, yet the core question, I mean, well, we've got that background, which is always interesting, but so what does Eusebius say about this material? I mean, what is how
Eusebius
does
is all for it. Eusebius is for the Eusebius was the ally of Arius. He was the ally of the letters of Christ. He was the ally of talking about the additional words of Christ. He wanted to see it all in an expose, which, by the way, got him in trouble with whom? With Constantine. Now, Eusebius was, in fact, the archbishop of the newly formed city of Caesarea, where Constantinople is. And Constantine loved Eusebius. There was a good relationship between Eusebius and Constantine, but Constantine literally invited Eusebius to step outside during many of the Nicene Council meetings. Why? Because Constantine did not want to look in the eyes of Eusebius when he was slashing and burning books. And he was told by Constantine to basically keep quiet. But whenever Constantine wrote his private ecclesiastical history of the church, he was a great ally of these letters, a great ally of the Septuagint, which was the first New Testament.
Old Testament.
Excuse me, the Old Testament.
Right.
I'm goofing up here.
That's okay.
But it was an expanded version of the Old Testament.
In Greek.
Right. Yeah, in the Greek. He was an ally of these kinds of things. And I think that's wonderful.
The material, you mentioned 5 million writings. That's a figure outside of the scope of my imagination from that period.
Well, can I...
Where do you find most of them?
Well, let's quote a scripture, first of all, to help you understand.
Okay.
Turn to the very last verse of the four Gospels.
Okay.
Which is John 21:25. Now, John knew Jesus better than anybody. He was Jesus' best friend. He was the only one who survived the entire night through the night of the crucifixion. All the rest of the apostles were gone. Peter had denied him halfway through the night and left. John was the only one who was there at the feet of the cross when they nailed him to a cross. What did John say? John said, "And many things Jesus did, I suppose if they were all written, the world itself could not contain all of the books that should be written."
Yeah.
In essence, he's talking about a rather huge body of potential writings.
Well, yeah, I mean, and as a literary expression, I mean, I would look at that as being, you know, exaggeration for metaphor. Still, 5 million, where do you find them? I mean, how have they gotten by?
Well, you're not going to find them in Jerusalem.
Okay.
We're going to find that in the East, not only in Hindu and Tibetan lore, but in Buddhist lore, we're going to find that there are hundreds of thousands of documents. The Dalai Lama, for example, I have met him, and I've met people who have known about this particular... I'm going to talk about a lot of different things here, but this is one area that we talked about tonight, so I'm going to talk about this specifically. The Dalai Lama says that he has 3 to 6 baskets of documents which pertain to the writings of the ancient 24 prophets and Jesus. Now, those baskets are as big as Volkswagens. I had somebody measure them one time, and they say they're as big as a Volkswagen Beetle.
Okay, that's pretty good.
That's a pretty good start.
Yeah.
The Dalai Lama has that one in his possession. He is waiting for his ancestors to give him permission to drop those on us. I've gotten a peek at some of those. I have not been given permission to speak of some of those. So until I do, I am respectful of that, and I'm not going to say anything. But they are huge amount of writings. We burned our books. They didn't burn their books, and they loved Jesus as much as we... Well, maybe not as much, but they loved Jesus too, okay?
All right. Well, we love to take phone calls for Glenn Kimball, and you can have that chance coming up in just a minute. We'll get to your questions and comments about the secret life of Jesus in the Orient, specifically in the East, in the areas of India and Tibet, where Glenn has been tracing the trade routes that run parallel to many of the best-known monasteries. And the written record, the hidden written record that exists on the life of Christ on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Punnett. The trip was through.
Say, here I am, on the road again.
But you are, it is not evidence that you are, in fact, that person.
Well, let's load up the phones for Glenn Kimball, and let's continue to go through your questions and comments on Glenn's research into the travels of Christ to the East. In fact, let me ask just, you know, although I know it's tempting to just kind of jump in with any old thing here, it would be so helpful, and I am so curious as to what you all are thinking specifically about the type of material that Glenn has presented and the proof that he is offering for those missing years in the unknown life of Jesus. Next on Coast to Coast AM, my name's Ian Bunnett.
Would you like to feel 10 years younger in 10 weeks? Now there's proof. The effects of aging can be slowed down and even reversed with HGH, human growth hormone. For some time now, you've heard me talk about the incredible age-reversing benefits of HGH. Well, according to thousands of articles, higher HGH levels can help you look and feel younger. That's why I take Ultimate HGH, a natural formula to help boost my body's own production of HGH. If your goal is to help improve energy, stamina, lose unwanted fat, diminish wrinkles, enhance memory, immune function, and vision, then Ultimate HGH is for you too. Why let Mother Nature get the best of you? Call today and order Ultimate HGH. And when you order two bottles of Ultimate HGH, you get the third absolutely free, about $33 a month. Now that's a tremendous savings off the typical $100 a month for comparable products. Plus, with your order, you'll receive a free book on HGH, a $20 value, absolutely free. So, call my good friends at Great American Products and order Ultimate HGH today at 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627. 1-800-557-4627.
Are you a worrier, a what-if thinker? What if I lose control? What if I have a disease? What if the plane crashes? Do you ever feel tired and overwhelmed just from worrying? That was me. I'm Lucinda Bassett, founder of the Midwest Center for Stress and Anxiety. For the last 15 years, I've dedicated my life to helping hundreds of thousands of sensitive, frustrated people recover completely from anxiety and depression, even when all other methods of help, including medication, have failed. What if you could stop worrying and obsessing? What if you could feel relaxed and finally have peace of mind? What if you could conquer your fears and enjoy life to the fullest? Don't let anyone tell you that you have to learn to live with overwhelming anxiety and depression. You don't. I've produced a seminar on tape about anxiety and depression that I'd like to send to you right now. Simply call 1-800-ANXIETY for my tape. It's time to stop worrying and start living again. Call 1-800-ANXIETY. That's 1-800-ANXIETY.
Phones are jumping for Glenn Kimball doing research into the unknown life of Jesus. And let's get to Rick in Lexington on the East of the Rockies line on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Rick.
Hello, Mr. Pinus.
How are you? You're talking to Glenn Kimball.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Kimball, I have your book, Hidden Stories of the Childhood of Jesus, which I read about 4 years ago. And I'd like to ask you about the crucifixion. When they crucify Jesus, is it true that they broke his legs when they crucified him?
No,
they did not break his legs.
No, they Cassius Longinus was sent by Pontius Pilate. Cassius Longinus was very famous, by the way, and elderly at that time. He had participated in the slaying of Julius Caesar some 60 years before, but Cassius Longinus thrust a spear into the side of Christ, and as the record continues in the Augustine charters and in the records of Raymond E. Brown from Harvard, he suggests that coming out of that wound was a clear liquid like water, which is characteristic of the morbidity of death. There's a water that comes inside the heart sac around the peritoneum. And if you pierce that after death, rather than blood coming out of a chest wound, it would be a clear fluid. And by the way, some of that splashed on into the eyes of Cassius Longinus, and he is recorded to have had some cataracts, which were slowly causing him to go blind. And they were immediately cured, and he was one of the most famous, unknown, very first converts to Christianity, and eventually followed in the exodus of the faithful many of the disciples who fled to Great Britain, and his grave is in Great Britain today.
Okay, thank you. One more thing, if I may. You talk about Jesus and being an Essene, am I correct?
His being what?
His family being the Essenes.
Essenes.
Essenes, whatever. Or would that be the same as being Gnostic?
No. Jesus's great uncle was a Pharisee. Joseph of Arimathea was clearly a Pharisee. Jesus's elder brother, his stepbrother actually, James was an Essene. And the Essenes were very politically different than the Gnostics. The Gnostics were located farther south in physical location than the Essenes. The Essenes were, let's put it simply, and this isn't totally accurate, but it'll give you a good idea of the differences between the two. The Essenes were conservatives, and the Gnostics were the liberals. The Gnostics were like the hippies in the desert who believed that religion began in your heart and that religion was an adjunct to that, and they ended up in an orgiastic cult in the 4th century, so that by the time of the Nicene Council, they were totally in disrepute, and they eventually fell apart because of their lack of central organization. By the 3rd century, the apostolic fathers in the north realized the need for strict structure. The only thing I was offended about there, several things offended me, but one of them was that they felt that the common people were too stupid to think for themselves or have a religious faith or perpetuate a faith or perpetuate their dogma or preserve their scriptures. The Gnostics in the South believed that nobody should control you, that you should believe as the Lord dictates in your heart, and that religion is an educational library for your religious path. The Essenes were very much more like the apostolic fathers in the north and were very different than the Gnostics.
Thank you, sir, for clarifying that.
Thank you, Rick. As always, let's go to the first-time caller line. Mark is in Norman, Oklahoma for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Mark?
Yeah. Hello, Ian.
Good morning.
Glenn. I just had a quick question for you. Sorry, I'm getting kind of nervous. First time caller. The traditional or the modern day view of Christianity based on the traditional version of the New Testament tends to be rather exclusionary. If you're not a born again Christian, then you're not going to heaven, basically.
Wow.
With Jesus spending a large portion of his time with the Buddhists, does he give any? Does he tend to be a little, is he giving any additional or a broader version of acceptance of other religions?
A more universalist approach.
Right.
A brilliant question, by the way. You shouldn't have been nervous to ask that one. The answer is definitely. Jesus was far more tolerant than we are in Western Christianity today. We follow we're more like the Jews at the time of Christ than the Jews at the time of Christ were. And I'm not befalling the Jews in general. The Jews were the bloodline of one of the chosen families of the earth and certainly somebody that to be totally respected. But the Jews began the process in the Maccabean era, 3 centuries before Christ, of burning books. And I am really against book burners as a specific behavior. And that's, in essence, what they did, and they began to be very cloistered and to exclude people from their fraternities and those kinds of things. Christ was the very first person to sit with the publicans and sinners. He did not like to sit next to the temple wall and pontificate with the rabbis. In fact, that's part of the reason why they hated him in Jerusalem but loved him in Galilee, is that the center of religion at the time of Christ was down in the homeland of Benjamin, and Judah, when up in Galilee, which was the home of the ten lost tribes, or the ten tribes, was the merchant capitals. And so when Jesus was in Galilee, these great merchants didn't care about sitting at the Wailing Wall and et cetera. They had a lot of common public houses and places that were would have common people in them, and they loved Christ. But when you got close to the seat of religious power, Christ said it best. You can get crucified in your own backyard easier, and the prophet's not respected in his hometown.
Let's go through the calls we have right now. Annie, hang on. We'll get to Roger, too, in Washington, and we'll take a bunch more questions and comments about the unknown life of Jesus and the research of Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.
I'm like a ghost. Some people can't see. Others just a drive-by and stay.
Problems and errors and mistakes, open mistakes. And so, you know, if we're going to condemn people because or holidays or institutions or cultures or religions because there are flaws, then let's not believe in anything and let's go sit in the corner and never celebrate a thing. I frankly have the feeling that we should take every opportunity, regardless of what it might historically have been based on, and celebrate whenever given the chance. I know that there were people who have been aggressed on. For example, the people from India who have been excluded from the story of Christianity because within India is a great quote-unquote pagan tradition where they have statues. You know, they feel the same way about us. There was a book called Christ in the Bible written in the 1870s where it was really kind of humorous because it pointed fingers at Moses and claimed that Moses was a ridiculous figure for having taken all those lower caste people and stupid people out into the desert when he could have spent his time with the princes of Egypt. The royal family members of India thought Moses was a joke because he went and deliberately picked out some slaves and tried to organize them and take them into the desert, you know? So, yeah, I think that our idea of trying to eliminate celebrations because they were once Roman pagan holidays has got to be one of the most myopic ideas. Let's celebrate Christ's birthday. It doesn't matter what day it is. Let's pick out Thursday, and let's celebrate it and not worry about it. You know, if you want to talk about Thursday, we're going to talk about the Thursday being a Roman day of the week.
Well, Thursday, of course, coming from Thor's day from the Norse mythology, but point taken. Let's get another round of questions and comments. They have all been challenging, they're all interesting, and I can't wait to hear what you all are going to come up with next for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett.
Do you want to lose 10 pounds in the next month? If so, then you better listen to me closely because I'm going to tell you about a revolutionary diet formula that's flap-taken this country by a storm. It's called Ultimate Slim. Ultimate Slim is unique, not only because it melts fat into energy, but it also does something most formulas just overlook. It addresses bloating. That's right. Listen closely, because I've got news for you. Regardless of how much you starve yourself, if you're bloated, you'll never get smaller. Once you stop bloating and release excess water buildup, you'll be amazed at how fast you'll lose inches. Again, Ultimate Slim is unique because it not only helps turn fat into energy so you'll burn fat and feel more energetic, but you'll also quickly lose water inches. Ultimate Slim works. It really works. Here's an introductory special offer. When you order two bottles of Ultimate Slim, you'll get two more bottles absolutely free. That's an incredible 50% off, and it's guaranteed to work or you get your money back. So call now. 1-800-557-4627. That's 1-800-557-4627.
800-557-4627. Commercials are more believable when real customers give a testimonial. So on the line with me is Karen Ellis, a Geico auto insurance customer. Karen, give us a testimonial.
Well, of all the canned peaches I've tried, I think the ones in heavy syrup are the best. They're just good.
There, a testimonial from a real live Geico customer who could save 15% or more on car insurance. Call 1-800-947-AUTO. 1-800-947-AUTO. Geico Direct, the sensible alternative.
The difference.
For over 60 years, Schiff has made the difference between an ordinary vitamin and a premium vitamin.
Schiff makes the difference.
By using natural vitamins whenever natural is more effective. By setting amounts for optimal health, not the minimum daily requirement. And with formulas that provide faster and better absorption.
The difference.
By providing premium vitamin supplements worth more because they offer more. Schiff
makes the difference.
Making a difference in vitamins. Making a difference in you. Schiff.
Well, we're going to get to as many people as we can for our remaining hour with Glenn Kimball. It's been 4 hours. It's just been fascinating. This topic is something which we could revisit again and again, and I'm sure we will sometime in the future. Marlo is in Ontario on the first-time caller line on Coast to Coast AM. Marlo?
Yes, how are you?
Doing so well. You're talking with Glenn Kimball.
Peace and grace be with you both.
Was that peace and grease or peace and grace?
Grace.
Just checking. Okay, go ahead.
Well, as I understand, from what I've been reading of the Essene writings, they claim that Jesus, or as they call him, Yeshua, was an Essene.
I don't know where that ever appears in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Pardon me?
I think every single culture wants to own Christ. I think if you're going to talk to the Islamic community, they would tell you that Jesus does not belong to Christianity or the Jews. He belongs to Muhammad.
Mm.
And this is very characteristic in all documents. But Jesus was no more an Essene than Fly to the Moon. The Essenes were very, very monastic in orientation. They never hung around women like Jesus did. Jesus had a following, an entourage of ladies that followed him all the time. There is no behavior in the life of Christ, with the exception of the homespun cloth that he wore, that is Essene.
Well, was it you, by the way, who said, when we are saved, we seek everything about God?
It doesn't ring a bell.
Oh, okay. And last thing. I understand his name was not really Jesus. Well, was it Yeshua?
Well, I know that there's a huge movement in especially in Western America, in Western Christianity, that is microcosmically focused on what name Jesus might have had or not had, or how you pronounce the name.
Well, the only reason I ask is that I have read scripture that says that I think John and Peter were going into a building, and there was a man who was crippled outside, and they evoked the name of Christ and said, "Rise," and he did. And because the name of Christ, the real name of Christ, would have such power that that may just be protected, you know, in that fact. And that the name Jesus was, I believe, originally given and adopted by the Greeks, who had a god, Zeus, and explaining it to the people would be easier, producing a name of Jesus.
That's not where it came from. The original messianic followers actually called, looked for a man to come into the meridian of time whose name would be Yeshus or Hesus. So there may be some similarities with Greek mythology, but that's not where the name Jesus came from. However,
It's funny you mentioned that. Can I mention, you mentioned something which I've noticed a lot on the phones. This seems to be a question that comes up a lot. Do you know of a movement? Is there something on the internet I'm missing where people keep going back to this name issue?
Me? Yeah. I notice it all the time.
Yeah, what is it?
I probably get an email a day from someone who says, you must use the correct name of Christ, you're going to hell.
Well, you know, like, Glenn, it was predicted from prophecy that there would be multiple Christ during his second coming. Were there multiple Christ back on the first coming? You know what I'm saying?
Your statement is an error. What they really were saying in the ancient text was that there were more than one Messiah. Now, the Messiahs, remember, the original, the meaning of the word Messiah is the anointed king with oil. The Messiah ben Judah was the Messiah we're most commonly familiar with, the Messiah of prophecy. However, there was more than one Messiah because there was more than one king anointed with oil. And so that's probably where your confusion comes in.
I see.
And there's so, and thank you, Marlo. There's
thank
some,
you.
Obviously, as Glenn has helped to sort out for us, there are so many different traditions coming from different places, different corners of the earth, all swirling around together that sometimes, without the type of work that Glenn's doing, it's really easy to get confused. You can hook up with Glenn. I want to say thank you for an absolutely riveting show, this on the occasion of Easter. We'll go to open phones for the rest of this hour. And Glenn, I look forward to getting you back on here, and we'll pick up on some of the tangents that you started to go down but wisely pulled back from, knowing that it was a whole other show. And we'll do another show on it sometime later on this year. And thank you for all of the material you sent me, too, because it's just fascinating. And we'll go to open lines on the way next for your questions and comments. Take the show anywhere you want to go on the way on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Baby,